Welcome to this, the second of the lecture in the series, Whatever Happened to Politics? And I'm very honoured that Larissa Berendt could come. But before I say more about her, I'd like to acknowledge that the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional owners of the land on which the University of Melbourne is situated, and acknowledge elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. Larissa is a Yulalai and Kamilaroi woman, and she's a professor of law and director of research at the Jumbana Indigenous House of Learning and the University of Technology, Sydney. She's admitted to the Supreme Court of ACT and New South Wales as a barrister. And when she gained her Master of Laws and Senior Doctorate of Jurisprudence, she was the first Aboriginal Australian to graduate from Harvard Law School. She has many distinctions, which are interesting not only for what they are, but for the great variety of them. She's a member of the Academy of Social Sciences of Australia and of the Australian Academy of Law. She's been the chair of the College of Experts in Humanities and Creative Arts of the Australian Research Council, and is currently on the Cooperative Research Centre's CRC committee. Larissa is a commissioner at the Land and Environment Court and the alternate chair of the Serious Offenders Review Board. She's the author of several books on Indigenous legal issues. In 2002, her novel Home won the David Unipon Award and a 2005 Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Her latest novel, Legacy, released in 2009, won a Victorian Premier's Literary Award. Larissa is a board member of the Museum of Contemporary Art and chair of the Bangara Dance Theatre. She was the inaugural chair of National Indigenous Television Limited and has been a director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. Larissa is an ambassador at the Gawara Aboriginal Campus at St Andrew's Cathedral School. And in 2009, she was the 2009 NAIDOC Person of the Year and New South Wales Australian of the Year in 2011. So you can see we're very honoured to have Larissa here tonight.
Welcome. I'd also like to begin by paying my respects to the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, pay my respects to their custodianship of this land and their generosity in sharing it with us, which is, I guess, an appropriate thing since we're here to talk about reconciliation. Now, I must confess that I actually, when I was invited to give this talk, I envisaged a small kind of tutorial room. So I've kept my remarks much more informal, but I think it'll work. And my lovely husband's been sick, and it seems like I'm just about to come down with the same flu that he's had with his generosity. So I apologise for being slightly, fading slightly tonight, but we'll see how we go. I've been thinking about the topic of what happened to reconciliation, not because I was wondering where it's gone, because I was wondering what I was going to say. And I was just actually talking to Ray before we came down, and he said he'd had the same lecture series with the same theme 5 years ago, and the fact we're still asking the question is probably a reflection in itself. But I was actually thinking when I agreed to do the lecture that it's 40 years since the Tent Embassy and 20 years since the Mabo case. So the fact that this question's still on the table shows how it's one of the perennial questions that we had. I was also thinking about the topic the last few days. We sadly in the Sydney community had a death of one of our elders, and there were preparations today, and I had to explain that I wouldn't be there in the community for it because I was coming here to give this lecture, and this lecture on reconciliation. And I was surprised that a couple of people in the local community had a very negative reaction to the word. It's not the first time I've heard it, but it was interesting just to get that reflection with people saying to me, you know, why do we talk about reconciliation? What do we have to reconcile? And reconciliation isn't that just about white people trying to feel good about themselves. And so it was an interesting sort of thing to be pondering as I was talking about this, because I guess we often think that part of the challenge is engaging non-Indigenous Australia, but it was a kind of interesting reflection that there's actually part of the agenda that's really about re-engaging Aboriginal Australia. And while it's sort of easy to be dismissive about some of those very cynical attitudes about reconciliation as a concept, I guess in some ways it's reflective of people's view that when we come to talk about how do we, you know, ensure a good and respectful relationship between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and the rest of the country, that we're probably not coming from an even playing field. And in thinking about the topic too, and I guess I wouldn't say I was dismissive, but kind of interested in some of those less sophisticated expressions about why we wouldn't care about reconciliation, it did also prompt me to think about the fact that I probably feel a little bit cynical about the concept too, and probably not the concept so much, but the way that the word's been used. I've recently been involved with doing a review of Indigenous higher education for the federal government, and as part of that review visited every university in the country. And, you know, obviously some do much better in terms of student numbers and staff numbers than others. And it was interesting that in some of the institutions when we would walk in and there would be statistically low student numbers, low retention rates, low numbers of Indigenous people working on the staff, and particularly low numbers of academic staff, that often the first thing people would say to us was, yes, we have a reconciliation action plan. And it seemed to me that this is, you know, in some ways it shows the energy that people put into the idea and concept and the value of reconciliation, but perhaps shows the challenge that the energy is often not always producing the results. Now, don't mean to label every reconciliation action plan with that, because some people do it better than others, but I think it was symbolic to me in a way that there is an energy and a sense that there's something important about reconciliation, but we perhaps don't know how to translate the symbolism into the practical outcomes that would really be meaningful for both sides. And I suspect if we were better able to articulate what those meaningful outcomes were, we would break through some of the cynicism on both sides of the equation about what that concept means. So it was also, again, in thinking about this in Redfern, which is where I was when I was having these conversations, there's, I guess, with the anniversary of the Mabo case, people thinking back to the very important moment at which Paul Keating came to Redfern to give the Redfern Park speech. And I happened to be there that day, not because I knew that it was going to be historic. I think we just heard the Prime Minister was coming to Redfern and we couldn't believe it, so we went down to see it. And I remember standing there as Keating delivered the speech amongst the rest of the community, and how surprised we were when we heard him say things like, we did the killing, we stole the children. If in terms of symbolism, it was a moment as importantly symbolic, in a symbolic terms, as Rudd's apology speech, but we perhaps don't see it in the same way. I think the thing about the difference in terms of looking at that as an era of reconciliation and then looking at the way in which we interpret it now, Keating's speech and Rudd's speech seem like two interesting points of contrast for me. Both incredibly historically important, and I don't take that at all away from the Rudd speech. My grandmother was a member of the Stolen Generations. My father also grew up in a home, so it was obviously a very important part of our family history, and it meant a lot to our family to hear that apology. And I think it meant a lot to Australians to see political leadership on this issue again. But it seemed to me that at the heart of it, the Keating speech was the beginning of a policy platform about substantive change around Indigenous issues. It led to the setting up of the approach to Mabo, which was setting up the National Native Title Tribunal, and it set up the Indigenous Land Council, Indigenous Land Corporation, which was, as you might know, a recognition that the Mabo case would not deliver land justice or compensation for everybody who had been dispossessed as part of the colonisation process. So the concept behind the Indigenous Land Corporation was that there would be a fund of money that would allow Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to purchase land. And there have been some significant purchases of land across the country as part of that fund, including most recently buying back the resort at Uluru, putting it into Aboriginal hands and making it a source of much greater employment, which was never able to be done apparently when it wasn't in Aboriginal controlled hands. So it was a speech that signified a quite solid agenda of transformative change. And as part of that agenda, there was also a discussion of a social justice package, which wasn't delivered, partly because the government changed, but it was certainly something that was at the time being mapped out by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, as it was called then, and ATSIC, as it once was. And you can still find that report, which is called Recognition, Rights and Reforms, which was, I guess, the blueprint for what people saw as a possible social justice package. And even today, all these decades later, it makes interesting reading to see what was a quite comprehensive roadmap for reform that included everything from increased education in our schools, increased protection of Indigenous culture, changes to the constitution, investment in employment. It's a very comprehensive blueprint for change, and that was part of the pattern. And then I think that's quite comparable then to, interesting to compare to the Rudd speech, which again was very powerful in its rhetoric, very strong and very moving. But the night before the speech, it was made very clear that the apology to the stolen generations would not lead to any discussion about compensation, which kind of, I think, in some ways dampens the mood of it a bit. But it was symbolic also, of a symbolic speech, about the fact that there was a willingness to engage in the strong symbolism, but not the same willingness to look at the more practical things that would flow from that. And, you know, I think I've always come from a position, I guess especially because I've been engaged so much with issues around policy and law reform, that the hearts and minds exercise is an extraordinarily important part of any other process of change that you want to do. It's not enough to make the great legal argument. You need to explain why it's an important thing and why it's an important thing for the country. And I think you saw that with the 1967 referendum, where you see over 90% of Australians from a broad range of backgrounds, a broad spectrum of politics, say that they were voting yes for a change that they thought at the time would lead to an improvement in the lives of Aboriginal people. You see these moments where that view about the importance of moving forward is there. And so I think, for me, that kind of starts to touch on why I think that there's perhaps becoming a bit of a lack of balance between the practical solutions that should follow the ideas of thinking about how we make the relationship much more productive, truthful and meaningful, and the symbolism around these things. Underlying it, I think, for me, is the fact that, and it goes, I guess, back to some of the cynicism that I heard around my local community about reconciliation, this idea that the playing field's never been even. And, you know, I think there's a narrative within the Aboriginal community that would describe that as the fact that we were a sovereign nation with our own laws and our own governance, and that has never been respected as part of the way that the dominant culture has come in. And for me, I think I see that institutionalised through our constitution, that moment of nation building that excluded so many people from our society in that important moment. And I think for me, the constitutional issue remains symbolic of the uneven playing field. So I'm going to just talk about that issue before I go on to some of the other things I wanted to touch on tonight, because it seems to me that at the end of the day, unless we do something to perhaps change that particular playing field, the rest of it's kind of moot. And what I think the starting point there is not even so much the exclusion and the symbolic act of exclusion from the discussions around how we construct our nation's founding document. It's also some of the other underlying assumptions that still lie within it. And I don't know how many of you sit at night and read the Constitution, but I'm sure it'd be guaranteed to put you to sleep in that it's not really a document, as a founding document of our country, that really is a riveting read. It's very dry, it's very pragmatic, it's very practical. So in some ways, when you read it, it's often hard to see how this document, which seems so pragmatic, could actually be so seen as so racist. But I think it's pretty easy to see from its actions, its how it's played out, that that's certainly the case. And part of that comes from the fact that at the moment in which we decided to construct this document, there was no doubt that there were issues of race that were pervasive at the time, and in a sense Indigenous people were only one small part of that, and in fact the fear of Chinese people and Asians was probably much greater and a much bigger driver in terms of the thinking that went into the Constitution. And the framers did have discussions about this. They looked at other constitutions that were around at the time that were persuasive. The French Constitution and the American Constitution with their deep history of democracy. And they specifically rejected the idea of putting rights into our document the way that it was in America. And it wasn't just because they didn't want to protect rights, though there is some evidence of that that I'll discuss in a minute, but just as powerfully, they decided that the issue of rights in Australia wasn't one that should be decided by judges, which is how constitutional entrenchment is decided. It goes to the court and they decide what it means, but is something that should be decided by the elected arm of government, that it should be something that people are able to discuss. And David Marr makes this observation about Australians, that he says that we like to mock authority, but actually when you look at how we behave with it, we're often very trusting of it. And I sometimes think of that when I look at this idea that you could trust the government to make decisions about rights. That's certainly what happened. But then, you know, there was a discussion about putting rights in, and rights like due process before the law and equality before the law were proposed and rejected specifically because people did want to be allowed to make racially discriminatory laws. And as I said, it wasn't really driven by views around Aboriginal people. You'll know that at the time this document was drafted, it was assumed we were a dying race, and the Constitution left issues of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to the states. The intention to allow racially discriminatory laws in the Constitution was much more actually directed at immigration, and you'll be aware that the first substantial piece of legislation passed by the Australian Parliament was the immigration laws that entrenched the White Australia policy, which I think is further evidence of how that was really at the forefront of people's minds in terms of that. So there's no doubt there were ideologies that that were prevalent in the crafting of the Constitution, some overtly prejudiced and others much more about the practical mechanisms of the way things would work. And so issue of the treatment of Indigenous people under the Constitution really then doesn't get raised again until 1967. Well, in fairness, it got raised 2 decades before then, when people started to think that looking at the way the states were looking after Indigenous people was so appalling, that they began to very strongly believe that if the federal government were to be given responsibility for Indigenous people, that that would be an assurance that Aboriginal people would be better treated, that the states had been neglectful. Now, that's true, even though, of course, the Northern Territory was under the jurisdiction of the federal government. But I think what's impressive about that lead-up to the constitutional reform is, as I mentioned earlier, the broad sweep of the Australian population that became engaged in that, from churches to trade unions, both sides of politics. It was 2 decades, really, of black and white Australians working together, thinking that constitutional change was going to be the answer. And I think what's interesting about that is that it shows that people understood this is a foundational document, and getting this right would set a different playing field. And I think it's also interesting, if you go back and look at what people thought this change would achieve, it's very clear that people believed, when they were voting yes in 1967, that they thought they were voting for a change that would benefit Aboriginal people to the extent that it would take them out of the cycles of poverty and the neglect that they saw occurring. And it was also clear that it's probably the rhetoric around some of this, many of you will remember the posters from that era that say "Vote Yes for Aborigines," had small children on it. It was came out of a citizenship rights movement from the 1930s, and actually really from the 1880s, that used the rhetoric of saying Indigenous people should have the right to be equal to all citizens. And that's, I think, why a lot of people thought that those constitutional changes were about achieving that. And you still hear today that people say 1967, that was when Aboriginal people first got the right to vote, that's when they got citizenship rights, that's when they stopped being treated as flora and fauna and all of those sorts of things. When in fact 1967 might have symbolically meant some of those things, but that's actually not what the change achieved. Its main change was that it gave the federal government the power to make laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That's the effect of the change. And it's interesting that people once again assumed that that was all you needed to change the constitution to have a flow on that meant naturally from that the federal government would act in a way that was beneficial to Aboriginal people. It again is the David Marr observation about trusting the parliament to make the right decision in relation to these issues. But the second change that was made at that time is also interesting in terms of looking at symbolism matching what's happening. It was a change that just changed the way that Aboriginal people were counted in the census. It's a funny historical aspect of the constitution, the inclusion in the census, or the exclusion from the census. It partly relates to how the population was treated in terms of the allocation of seats for parliament, and it was decided that Aboriginal populations shouldn't skew that, because it was partly the fact that they weren't seen as voting, and it was partly used to allocate funds as well. So it was an anachronism within the constitution, but people involved in the 67 referendum campaign saw this change as really almost a nation-building exercise. They believed that if Aboriginal people were included in the census in this way, it was a way of, you know, changing the way that they were seen as being outside of the Australian population and made us all as part of the same population. And I think you can argue the extent to which that happened, but it's interesting that they thought that this was an important symbolic change at the same time. And the fact that this constitutional change was seen as being a trigger to a more equitable relationship was something that I think both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people had a great deal of hope in. But you see people involved in the 1970s civil rights movement, particularly the Tent Embassy, who said, well, we woke up on the day after the referendum and nothing in our life had changed. And a couple of years later, nothing in our life had changed. We're still living in poverty, still being controlled. There was no discernible change. And that was kind of the impetus towards being involved with a, I guess what people might describe as a more hardline kind of politics, but at the same time it was a politics that resonated with global changes around the way that people were looking at otherness. It was as influenced by the Black Panther movement as it was by the feminist movement, so it was also going into a different era, but I think that the disillusionment with the extent of that change was quick and reflective of the fact that it really didn't change the playing field the way that people had hoped. We see some good examples of that now, more clearly. The Hindmarsh Island Bridge case brought that into really strong relief. You might recall the circumstances of that case where there was a dispute about a bridge being built across Aboriginal land. There were dispute amongst the community about the importance of the land, but in order to resolve the dispute amongst all of the parties, the federal government decided to just repeal heritage protection laws so they didn't apply to the Indigenous people of that area, which also meant they had to repeal the Racial Discrimination Act from applying because it was racist. So that's the legal test, but they took this case all the way to the High Court, and they argued that in 1967, when Australians voted to change the Constitution, they had done so with the strong belief that this change to the Constitution, this power that was given to the federal government, would only be used for the benefit of Aboriginal people, and nobody intended it to be used differently. And the High Court, with Justice Kirby dissenting, said that even if that was the case, that could be the case, and that's an interesting argument, but you look at the language of that provision in the Constitution and it's quite clear. It simply talks about the fact that the federal government has the power to make laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. There's no qualifier to that says it has to be beneficial. And so if the Commonwealth has the power to make a law that might give a benefit, it also has the power to take it away. And I think that's probably a really good example of how that intention to change the playing field hasn't worked. I think in terms of looking at that legacy from an Indigenous perspective in looking at how the Constitution treats Aboriginal people, the Hindmarsh Island issue becomes one particular point of contention. There is also, of course, the fact that the Racial Discrimination Act, which is primarily the primary protection against racial discrimination for Aboriginal people, is repealed only 3 times since it was passed, and that is in relation to the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case, in relation to the Native Title Amendment case, and in relation to the Northern Territory intervention. So there's a strong narrative and perspective that says that it's only when it's Indigenous rights that are being violated that we see an overturning of the racial discrimination protection. And that's, I think, become quite symbolic for Aboriginal people of the way in which this playing field still remains uneven. And I just would say one other thing about the playing field not being even. I think the other case that's in people's minds about this is Kruger and the Commonwealth, the 1997 case, which was brought by Indigenous people who had been removed under the Northern Territory Ordinance, and one of the and a parent who'd had her child taken under that ordinance. And unlike cases like Gunner and Cabillo that are argued on the basis that there was a duty owed and the duty was breached and therefore there's compensation owing as a tort case or a duty of care case, the plaintiffs in this case argued that the removal of children under this ordinance breached certain fundamental human rights, which included the right to due process before the law and equality before the law, which I think is really symbolic since they were two rights that were specifically argued against in terms of being included in the Constitution. The right to freedom of religion, which is actually in the Constitution, and freedom of movement, a couple of other rights, but I think fundamentally they're really good examples of the point I'm trying to make, which is this. The High Court found that even though the policy may have infringed on some of those rights, there was no remedy under Australian law for those breaches. So basically there was no remedy for people. They didn't really have to decide it because there was no remedy for the plaintiffs. And I think what's important in talking about symbolism about this case is that you see a case that isn't argued on Indigenous issues. It's not about culture, history and language. It's argued on rights as fundamental as due process before the law and equality before the law. And the answer, what it illustrates for Australians, I think, is two things. One is that some of the rights that we would assume would be somewhere protected in our legal system, some way, just simply aren't. And I think it allows us to put forward the thesis that when those rights aren't protected, it's almost most likely that people from the most vulnerable sectors of the community, the historically marginalised, the socioeconomically disadvantaged, the culturally distinct, that will be most affected by the failure to protect those rights. And I think that that's certainly a conclusion in relation to Indigenous people. And so I think then if you look at that as the playing field and that as the legacy, the issue about talking about reconciliation in simply symbolic terms becomes somewhat empty. I think that part of the conversation has to be about fixing the playing field. And I know that there's some discussions in the public domain now about that. I'd just put forward this as my thoughts on this subject. You can look at countries like Canada that are quite comparable to us in terms of its history, its treatment, its socioeconomic issues around Indigenous issues, its current outstanding issues to be resolved, and see that they've been much more generous in how they've tried to approach the issue of constitutional protection. From 1982, they've had a specific constitutional protection in their Charter of Rights that protects Aboriginal and treaty rights. It's a very simple provision. In fact, all it says is basically Aboriginal and treaty rights are hereby protected. So it doesn't articulate it, doesn't get into an argument. And those issues about what that actually means in practice fall to the judiciary to decide. And it should be pointed out that that hasn't meant a blanket protection of Indigenous rights. There's been a lot of instances now where the jurisprudence has developed. So it's really been interpreted as about balancing the rights of Indigenous people in treaty and common law against Canada's right to development. So it hasn't been a blanket protection, but I think it's interesting to look at the level at which Canada's been comfortable to put in constitutional protection compared to what we've done here and where the discussion goes. I think it's a great idea to think about a preamble to the Constitution, but it concerns me that often the talk of recognition of Aboriginal people in the preamble gets qualified by saying it can't have any legal weight, whereas in most instances a piece of legislation would use its preamble to help you interpret when there's a grey area. It seems a kind of empty symbolism. And I think the argument about how you recognise Indigenous people in a preamble, what's the words that you use, what weight do you give it, how do you balance it against all the other values as a country we would want to put into a preamble, it's an important public conversation. I think it's a very worthwhile public conversation that forces us to think about what our values are. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure it's the only or best option we have for fixing that playing field. Although I've mentioned the Canadian constitutional solution to Indigenous rights and intention to recognise them explicitly. I think we could fix a lot of the issues we have around failure of laws to protect Aboriginal people by going back to something that our framers overlooked and simply putting in the right to due process before the law and the right to equality before the law. Because at the end of the day, most of the injustice that Aboriginal people feel that draws them to the courts is not necessarily always just characterised as something that infringes on their identity as Aboriginal people. It often infringes quite simply on basic fundamental human rights and due process before the law. So if I can give you one example of that from recent times, which is from the intervention. When the intervention rolled out in the Northern Territory, it designated over 70 Indigenous communities as being prescribed areas. In those prescribed areas, everyone had to go on to a form of income management, which was imposed by the federal government. In order to put that policy in, the Racial Discrimination Act had to be suspended because it was racist. But as well as doing that, the federal government also suspended the right of people in those areas to complain to the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner in the Northern Territory, and also suspended the right of people in those areas to appeal to the Social Security Appeals Tribunal. So if you were a person living in one of those communities and you had a problem with the way that your income management was working with Centrelink, you did not have a single body in Australia that you could go to make a complaint. Now, that might seem like a simple thing to some people, but I think if you are a person living on income management or on a income support in a remote area and you have a problem, you really want to be able to get somebody to fix it. And I think not giving people the chance to fix it or to complain that it's wrong was a human rights breach in terms of due process before the law that just would not be tolerated anywhere else in Australia. And perhaps people didn't appreciate that that's how it worked, but that's how it worked. And it would seem to me that if you had just a simple right to due process before the law, you could ensure that people weren't disenfranchised in that way again. And that just seems to me to be one instance of the sorts of issues that you would fix if you could do that. So I wanted to just then move on to talk a little bit about policy in general and then finish with a couple of more observations about the balance between symbolism and practical outcomes and what that means for reconciliation. I think that one of the unintended consequences of the 1967 referendum has been one of the biggest problems in terms of why we can't solve intractable issues around Indigenous communities, particularly around things like education and health, and that is that when the 67 referendum gave the power to the federal government to make laws for Aboriginal people, it wasn't a blanket responsibility. And along the way, it's meant that there's been a sharing of responsibility between federal and state and now territory governments. And rather than that being a situation in which both levels of government work together, ensuring resources are allocated effectively, and that they work together to develop appropriate policy, it's actually led to a situation where both levels of government blame each other for policy failure, and both levels of government try to shove the cost of fixing those problems onto the other level, which is why you see such, despite the level of need of Aboriginal people, such a huge underspending. As you might be aware, in the Northern Territory, for example, where it's absolutely well known how important it is to be focusing on the education of young people, we see the failure to provide enough teachers and classrooms in Aboriginal communities, and work done around the COAG trial in Wadi showed that only 45 cents was spent on the education of Aboriginal children for every dollar spent on the education of non-Aboriginal children, partly because the Northern Territory government, which had been country Liberal, but then had also been Labor, so this isn't a political, it's not a one political party that does this, but both sides of government, had funded schools on attendance rather than enrolments, thus further bringing down the amount that they were allocating. And so initiatives that are implemented in those communities that are designed to ensure that parents all bring their kids to school often result in situations where if all the kids do turn up at school, there isn't enough places for them. And at the heart of it, I think in the time that we've got, I'd just like to flag that as one of the real ideological problems around policy that I see at the moment. I think it's very easy to say when you look at the level of truancy in Aboriginal communities, especially in remoter areas, that this must clearly be a problem of bad parenting and that the best way to fix it is to punish parents. It seems to be a very simple rhetoric that is very politically saleable. But we know when we look at why kids in those areas don't go to school that the attitudes of parents is actually one of the lesser reasons that's influential. So it's much more about the culture of the schools. It's much more about the extent to which the curriculum engages Aboriginal kids, which is why bilingual education programs have been so successful in some of the areas where they're resourced properly. They enable kids to learn to read words in their own language, so they recognise letters, which allows them to then better read English. It's the same way that bilingual is taught in other languages, not just Aboriginal languages. Those are the sorts of initiatives that are community-driven. They're often the result of a community project. They require the local community to come into the school to co-teach. They require the teacher to spend a lot of time in the local community to learn the language. They're resource intensive, but they work because they create that relationship of trust between the community and the school. So where that doesn't occur, we see higher levels of truancy. And it's also an issue of the quality of teacher education as well. And as I said, resourcing of classrooms. There's also the issue of overcrowding. That's a huge issue in truancy. You'll be aware of the issue of overcrowding in many Aboriginal communities, which leads to a multitude of problems, but including the fact that it's not a great place for learning, but also infectious diseases, and the issue of ear infections is actually another learning problem which should be easily fixable. But at the heart of what I'm trying to say is that these simple solutions that seem to just say, well, this is about, you know, bad parenting, so we punish parents, does seem to ignore the fact that there's a lot that we see in the solution that is actually the responsibility of government to provide. So again, when we talk about reconciliation, I think there's an extent to which you can become quite cynical if the approach of government is to say, well, this is all about you having to perform better and behave better, but their responsibility to provide basic services, classrooms and teachers is not being met. And I think that the other point that I want to draw out of that is that we do see lots of examples where communities aren't dysfunctional, and we do see lots of examples where there have been great solutions to really difficult problems. The issue of violence in some Aboriginal communities is obviously an issue that's very perplexing, has very complex historic and social roots. And in some of those communities, very simple ideas like having dry out shelters or a bus that will pick people up and take them to a safe place is a very simple solution to those sorts of things. And again, the point of that is that where you see these kind of simple solutions, it's never because governments in the cities have decided this is a great program, let's roll it out. It's because communities have understood that there's a problem there, and they usually know the best way to find a solution. And I was even more convinced of that after the recent research project we've done at Jumbana, working with the New South Wales Attorney General's department, looking at Aboriginal communities in New South Wales where there are high crime rates and low crime rates. And one of my favourite examples that I saw in terms of trying to explain to people why is it that you'll have one community that's dysfunctional and yet down the road there'll be another community that's working, is is this story that I'll tell you. And it cuts through, of course, a history of two different communities that have had a whole range of different issues. But in Wilcannia, which is one of those classic communities that's always labelled a basket community, it's one of those communities that has, as I mentioned before, with this era of cost shifting, both levels of government flying bureaucrats in every day and out every day to be able to trying to fix the problems there. There's a lot of money going into programs in that community. If you fly out to those areas, especially to Broken Hill, the planes are packed because they're full of bureaucrats going out to help the people of Wilcannia. And somebody's making a lot of money. But and then down the road, you've got this town of Menindi, which doesn't get much attention at all because it doesn't have the same social problems that Wilcannia. And in our work, when we were asking people about issues with truancy in Wilcannia and the problem of getting kids to stay at school, answers that we got to those questions were things like, well, there's no point in going up to talking to the principal because he's racist, he's worse than the one that was there before and he's only been here 6 months. The PNC don't get on with the Aboriginal community. And what's the point? There's never been a shop in the main street that's employed an Aboriginal person, so why bother? Why bother going to school? And then you go down to Menindi and ask about issues of keeping kids in school and how do they do it. And they say, well, if the kids don't go to school, Aunty Beryl gets in the bus, she goes down to the riverbank where they go, picks them up and takes them to school. That's a really simple solution, but I think what's really important about the difference between those two examples is that when you go to Menindi, you see a community that when it has a problem, it just does not believe that it has the ability to be able to fix it. Nobody helps, nobody gives anything, everyone's completely disillusioned. There's no point in creating any relationships because the teachers change over as quickly as the police officers. So anytime anyone tries anything new, it's a short-term thing and they just lose their energy. Whereas Menindi, you see a group of people who, if there's a simple problem, they don't need anybody to come and help them, give them a handout, give them money, tell them what to do. They don't need a program and they don't need a bureaucrat. They just find a way to do it. And they're not a rich community. And I think one of the interesting examples that we saw there in terms of how far this goes in terms of the importance of the empowerment of a community is that, along the way you'll notice I've made a few implied critiques of the bureaucracy's role in all of this, but the government came up with the idea that in order to help with after school, with truancy and antisocial behaviour after school, they would institute a program that would help with after school activities. They decided to do this by building a shed in different communities so that you could do the whatever it would be in those communities that you would do. So a shed's built in Wilcannia. There's nobody uses it. It's hot. It gets hot there in the summer. There's no heating. There's no program, you know, nobody wants to come in and do anything after school, so the shed's just basically wasted. In Menindi, they said, oh, we're going to come in and do an after-school program, we're going to build you a shed. And the auntie said, what do we want a shed for? Like, what do we want you a shed for? We don't want a shed. What we want is somebody to come in and do these programs with the kids, and if you're not going to do that, then we don't want your shed. And I have to say, in the times that I've worked in Indigenous Affairs, it's rare that you see a community say, if we don't like what you're offering us, so we're not going to take it. But it seems to me that's the level of empowerment that you get in these communities where people are quite capable of taking care of themselves. And it always puzzles me that we spend so much, the bureaucrats spend so much time going into Wilcannia, basically doing the same programs over and over. You'll have the federal and the state governments doing programs in the same areas, completely duplicating their services, and yet not talking to each other because they're two levels of government, often two colours of politics. And the most perplexing thing that's come out of this research is that it seems that the way in which these services go into towns like Wilcannia and then get ripped out, go in, ripped out, bureaucrats fly in, services are flown in and out, is much more detrimental to the social fabric of the community than a place like Menindi that's pretty much left under the radar and untouched. there's a lesson in that, I think, in terms of thinking about longer term solutions to some of these intractable socioeconomic problems. And it seems to me that the obvious thing is about the importance of investing in human capital, where you have a group of people that are perfectly able to solve their own problems. And one thing we don't often do in this area is look at what works in particular areas and then roll it out into the other areas. And I'm not saying that that's an easy solution for a place like Wilcannia that has decades, even centuries of dysfunction to fix. But what I'm saying is where we've got places like Menindi that operate like that, we've got to make really sure we don't do anything that upsets that social fabric. But I think it is a perennial problem within policy, and this is not just something in the Indigenous Affairs portfolio. I think it's anywhere. I think we think about how we fix solutions in terms of programs and program dollars, but we don't think so much about how do we invest in people, how do we invest in human capital, how do we invest in capacity. And that's until we start to think about that, I think we're going to have these intractable problems. So let me just finish with this other observation that I wanted to make about that, because that issue of the importance of making people feel empowered and how you do that is at the heart of what I think is a couple of other real barriers to any kind of reconciliation. It kind of makes a mockery of them. There's a strong narrative that's re-emerged in discussions around Indigenous affairs that says that a lot of the social problems within Indigenous communities, especially around violence and abuse of children, is because Aboriginal culture condones that. That's a view that's really contested by Aboriginal people, and it's true in most of our traditional cultures that behaviour that was disrespectful to Indigenous women was punished. But at the same time, I think that it's important to note that it is the case that over time in some communities, antisocial behaviour and criminal behaviour has become normalised and tolerated. That doesn't say that it's Aboriginal culture. And I look at something like bilingual education, where you see the central role that Aboriginal culture plays. And it's not right to say that Aboriginal culture is always the source of some kind of evil. You look at bilingual education programs, you see how the use of teaching Aboriginal cultural language, working with Aboriginal cultural examples, is actually a really great way to engage kids with their learning. And you look at the work done, the very influential work done by people like Chris Sara, who focused on the need to get teachers to believe that Aboriginal people can achieve, Aboriginal kids can achieve, they don't have high aspirations for Aboriginal kids, and that has to change. So part of his program is about getting kids to believe that they can achieve well, and that achieving well academically is important. But he marries that with a set of activities and priorities that are about building self-esteem and confidence in kids. And one of the ways he does that is to make them proud of their cultural heritage and who they are. And they seem to me to be two examples where respect for culture and respect for your identity and respect for who you are is really important in building up a person who's going to be able to achieve things and who is going to be an agent of change and somebody who's going to have their own agency in the way that we need it to be. So this rhetoric around the fact that Aboriginal culture is evil and bad, I think, has been very damaging in a practical way as well as in a more symbolic way. And the other rhetoric that's come into the discussion that I think has been really detrimental is the assertion that's been made in politics that self-determination failed, which is basically an argument that says Labor government had a policy called self-determination. They set up ATSIC as part of that. ATSIC failed, and therefore self-determination is a failure. It seems to me both sides of politics have kind of accepted that argument. I mean, I don't think ATSIC was as big a failure as people said, and certainly there were some gaps afterwards. It wasn't perfect. But even to say that about ATSIC was simplistic. To say it as a general statement is overly simplistic and it's wrong. You can't on the one hand be saying self-determination has failed, but then on the other know that if you want to make real changes in communities, you need women like the women that you need in Menindee, who are in every sense self-determining. It seems to me that that is a debate that has been completely unhelpful and kind of one run on ideological lines rather than looking at what's actually happening on the ground. So you could call it capacity building if you wanted to avoid all of the issues about self-determination, but it seems to me that the debates, the ideological debates about self-determination failing have been really detrimental. And this is the point I wanted to conclude on. It says to me how far we've got to go in terms of reconciliation if two of the main narratives around Indigenous affairs remain: Aboriginal culture is evil and self-determination has failed. I think that both of those assertions need to be countered and can't be part of the starting point if we're going to achieve reconciliation either in a symbolic way or in a practical and meaningful way.
Larissa will take questions, but I should say, given that you're not feeling well, if you give me a nod if you want to stop.
Well, said we'd go to 8, so well, I think I'm good for it.
Okay.
Larissa, I watched Andrew Forrest present his speech to the National Press Club recently, and he seemed to be saying that if you're going to pour money in training Aboriginals to make sure there's a meaningful job at the end, do you agree with that basic philosophy, and how's his objective in trying to put more Aboriginals in the mining industry going? Is he being successful, as he had hoped?
I'm not sure about how successful he's been with the... I just don't know that information. Look, I think the idea of getting Australian businesses to sign up to give 50,000 jobs to Aboriginal people was a great way to get employers to think about employing someone. This is no reflection on Andrew Forrest's ambition, but I think where the process has fallen down is, say this from working in a university, the challenges around getting somebody into a job are always around the skill set. From year 7, Aboriginal kids are behind in science and math in particular, and literacy as well, but more so with science and math. They're not directed into the courses at high school and then into university that would lead to being an engineer, if you're talking about mining, or to be a doctor, etc. This goes a bit into the issue around aspiration I was talking about before, but it's also around the levels of education. When we get Aboriginal students into the door at a university, the last problem they have is getting a job. There are heaps of people who want to employ an Aboriginal person once they graduate. It's people who want to invest in the training of Aboriginal people to get to that point that is the bigger problem. And so, I guess what I would say is that it's great that people put their hand up to say, yes, we'll give jobs to Aboriginal people. If you look at the job site where it is, a lot of them require skills, and it's fine to say, well, if an Aboriginal person comes along, we'll employ them. But I think the bigger challenge is if you really want to see more people in your profession, then perhaps the investment has to be greater, and it might be things like, which, you know, some professions like the legal profession do this, where they offer scholarships or support that is much more mentorship. And I think even more important, it's all very well to talk about the pathway from university, but it's actually getting them to the point where they would be ready for that. I think where we need to see much more action is with kids from year 7 to 9. That's important in terms of giving people an understanding that they might have more options than just going into a job. It's a huge issue in the rural and remote areas that the incentive to earn is higher than the incentive to learn, if you understand what I mean. And it seems to me that we need the critical investment needs to be around year 7 and 9, where kids have to not just be brought up to the same skill set, but need to know what their real options are. So just to finish on this final point, we don't have trouble getting Indigenous people interested in areas like law and medicine and teaching so much, medicine now, but it used to be health, because they see that every day in their communities. They see police, they see doctors, they see teachers. It's harder to tell kids in that age group what they can do for their community if they become an engineer. So there's quite a bit of work that needs to be done around aspiration building as well. If you explain it's about fixing houses or whatever it is, and show great role models, that goes a long way. But it seems to me that it's all very well to say, well, there's a job here. If I've got a capable Aboriginal person, I'll give it to them. I think that's kind of the easy way out, and there's a lot more investment. It's an investment the government needs to make. It's an investment the community needs to make. It's an investment schools and the universities need to make. And it's an investment that professions need to make as well.
I've still got three going in the Czech chat, and then behind, and then lady here and there. Okay. And then I'll start up again.
Okay, because that might take us to 8:30, the way I've been answering these questions. Might take us to 9:30.
Thank you, Larissa. I'm interested in constitutional recognition, the process that's been put forward, the recommendations by the expert panel. I was struck by the way that you spoke about the Keating's Redfern speech was then followed up with meaningful, you know, actions afterwards, but Rudd's apology was not followed up with that. Where does the recommendations for constitutional recognition sit in terms of that idea of, are there meaningful reforms that can be attached to it to give it meaning, or is it an empty symbolic thing?
Okay. I do think the constitutional agenda is important. I think it's important that we get it right. We don't want to see another 67 referendum where, for some reason, what we've aspired to do doesn't achieve the change that we want. I think there's an issue of fatigue and there's an issue of energy and all of that. So this is, in a way, this is a really important opportunity. We've got to get it right. It took 20 years to get the level of support for the last constitutional change. So it's always been my view that constitutional change as part of this process will be a long-term thing. It might not be 20 years, but it won't be something that I think you can turn around. I think we're at a stage where people who are interested in it are talking about it, but it needs to go well beyond that, or the worst outcome will be you put something up that recognises Indigenous people in the Constitution and it fails. If you talk about symbolism, you don't want that. So I think that there's a longer time that needs to take place, and I think it's probably helpful to look at the recommendations of the expert panel as a starting point, which is, I think, probably how they intended it. These are debates that we need to have as a community about, you know, what do we want to achieve with this? What does it mean? What's the relationship with Aboriginal people? If we don't have those conversations as part of the process, then I think we miss an opportunity to engage people in the same way that 67 engaged people's hearts and minds. I do think it's an important part of the agenda. And so not only do I think that it will take time, it's my strong view that whatever ends up there has to be more than symbolic. And there are some of the, you know, that they didn't propose a preamble, but they've proposed a couple of symbolic recognitions and a couple of symbolic removals, and that's great. But my strong view is that it can't just be symbolic. And I should just, I should clarify one thing. I think in terms of looking at what's the action in Indigenous that's labelled Indigenous Affairs, it's been a policy failure. But there have been policy successes in other areas, like the new national cultural policy places Indigenous Aboriginal stories as part of the national story in a way that it hasn't done before. And the impact of the NBN in remote communities, especially for opportunities around learning, is actually going to be, I think, a really positive thing. So it's, I guess, an irony that I see if you look at where there has actually been some potential and improvement around Indigenous issues, it's often not because it's in the Indigenous Affairs portfolio, but it's actually in the broader health portfolio, the broader education portfolio, or in the arts portfolio, and that's where you get it. And surely that's not a great outcome if we're only getting it despite the fact that we've got Indigenous Affairs on the table. So I think, you know, we need to get that stuff right first, but the the constitutional stuff, I think we need to take the time to get it right and make sure it's meaningful.
Do you still have the mic? Yes, the man with the hand up with a...
Thanks very much, Larissa. Mine's a similar question. You've mentioned a few times that inserting in the Constitution protections for basic rights like due process would be a way forward. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on how you'd see that being different to the outcome in the Hindmarsh Islands case. What would distinguish those protections from the supposed protection we already had?
Okay. The key thing is if something's in the Constitution, it can't just be repealed because the government wants to simply change a law. And you could have a protection about Indigenous rights in there, which I think would be very difficult to achieve to get in there in the first place. But I think if you had something that was just about equality before the law, you would be able to use it in situations where there was going to be an inherent difference in the way you were treated as opposed to another Australian. And that example I used about the way that people who were being income managed couldn't appeal to the Social Security Appeals Tribunal may come into one of those areas. So I think you can see actual places where, examples where that would make a difference. I mean, I'm kind of, it's not an each way bet, but it's not wanting an either or but a both approach that I take. I'm not in favour of legislated bill of a list of rights the way that the Americans have it entrenched in the Constitution. I think there's a lot of benefits for a community to have a process where it's about balancing rights to privacy against, say, the right to free speech, for example, that's something that we're involved in as a community to decide where that line should be. We can lobby our parliamentarians, we can have public debates about it. I think there's a lot to be said for how balancing some of those other rights can take place as part of a public discussion. And I also think, you know, it allows the rights that we have within our legal system that aren't entrenched in the Constitution to be a kind of living document. The example I guess everyone knows is the Americans' right to bear arms is something that becomes an anachronism after a while. But, you know, we've seen an enormous amount of change in terms of the way rights are impacted by scientific discoveries around a whole range of different things. The internet changes how we think about rights to privacy, all of those sorts of things. I think it helps us keep a much more vibrant idea about rights if we have those discussions publicly. So I'd just propose that we put a few rights into the Constitution, and for me, I think due process before the law and equality before the law would be the two rights. You could add right to freedom from racial discrimination from that, but those two rights would be something that would set the legal system in a way that would at least provide a playing field of equality that we just don't have now. And it would make a difference in the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case because you would have breached it by not allowing people to have the heritage protection legislation when everyone else had it. You would have had it in the changes with the extinguishment of native title because that was the way property right was being treated when other people's property rights weren't being treated the same way, and it would have stopped that discrimination in the intervention. So I think you can point to places where you don't need a litany of these rights to provide what would be basic protections. It leaves a lot unprotected. I mean, that might not protect cultural heritage, it might not protect language, but I think it's at least the bottom line or the minimum that you would need to be able to say we've fixed the fundamental issue of problem with equality in our constitution.
I was interested when you were speaking about the strength and resilience of the Menindee community and their self-determination, and was thinking about, well, how would they survive if they were within the Northern Territory? And there must be other communities who have had a similar self-determination and or attempted self-determination and that resilience like the Menindee community. So I was just interested if you have any information on how communities are surviving in the Northern Territory and the impact of the intervention. And also, I'm just wondering, will they only have an avenue through law if the constitution is changed with these rights that you're suggesting need to go in?
Well, that's a great question, but I don't think I've got a happy answer for you. I think with the length of time it would take to change the playing field with the constitutional changes that I've suggested in the process, I think it's probably too late. I've worked with communities around the Northern Territory since the intervention, and I think for me, of all the things that have happened since, the increase in suicide rates, the increase in truancy, the increase in malnutrition and anemia in children under five, one of the things that worry me the most about long-term solutions, especially when I hear politicians from both sides of Parliament talk about how concerned they are about women and children, is the way in which the knowledge of people in the community, sometimes especially women, was completely ignored. You look at a health service like Sunrise Health Service that had better than average outcomes, health outcomes for the community around Katherine that it serviced before the intervention. It was the first, because it kept such good records, it was servicing more children than the fly-in, fly-out doctors doing health checks as part of the intervention, because they would catch the families that wouldn't go to see the fly-in, fly-out health services because they had much stronger community connections and knew where some of the perhaps more problematic families and children were. They were the first to identify that anemia rates were rising and that people had been reporting being hungry when their payments hadn't come through, and had a couple of very disturbing examples. Like, there was a person who had diabetes who couldn't use their card over the weekend and had to sleep until they could get food. Just appalling in our country that this happens. They identified and documented that, and the government response was to cut their funding so they couldn't engage in that sort of stuff. And the other example that I think is appalling, if you want to look at these examples of where you can tangibly see communities that have been destroyed by this, is Tanindeer Council. It was the council that serviced the town camps around Alice Springs. It ran breakfast and lunch programs for kids. It employed 300 to 450 people under CDEP. It made sure the rubbish was collected from the town camps. It ensured that there were services to those, like buses, to those communities, because the Alice Springs wouldn't even go and collect the garbage from the town camps. The Tanindeer Council did it. Tanindeer Council also was critical of the intervention. It had its funding cut. It's a shell of what it used to be. There's no CDEP programs. The government's funded non-Indigenous NGOs to run the breakfast and lunch programs that Tanindeer Council used to do. So it's not only just that they know that these things are important, they're just belligerent about not giving it to an Aboriginal community organisation. When it brought in the incredibly racist housing policy it has, where Aboriginal community housing has to have its land leased back to the government, non-Indigenous housing, social housing doesn't, but Aboriginal housing has to, Tanindeer Council were going to resist that. They got told their land would be forcibly acquired, so they agreed to go into the government lease. They had said to the government, we have a non-Indigenous housing provider from Melbourne who'll partner with us so that we can still be the landlord on these areas, and they were told no. It's just a belligerent ideological thing, and this wasn't the government that introduced it under Howard, this is the government that's there now. So Tanindeer Council is a shell of its former self. It took 30 years to build up that organisation, and they have undone it in a couple of years. And this is what worries me. This is that if there's one thing that I find the most unforgivable about the impact of this policy, is you go to places that did have people, where you had those people who were who are just those people that make the community work. There's one woman who kind of makes it work. They're completely demoralised because they weren't asked a single thing about this policy. They weren't asked about what worked in their communities. They weren't asked about what programs were there. They weren't asked about their expertise. They weren't asked about their community resources. They were taken over and they were treated as part of the problem. They were disempowered and shoved to the side. The morale that was... The low morale in those communities is a huge long-term problem, and that's what I was saying about the importance of places like Menindee. You've got to make sure you don't lose that. They've lost that. And I wonder, you know, in 10 years' time, whatever government we have, some Aboriginal Affairs Minister for the first time will go and visit an Aboriginal community in the Northern Territory and go, oh my God, how did this happen that we've got such malnutrition and truancy here? Send in the army. And one day they'll decide that, OK, we've got to have Aboriginal people involved with these solutions. And who are they going to turn up to? Because there's nobody at Tanangere Council anymore. It took 30 years to build up a community organisation for an impoverished, underskilled community, and they've destroyed it. When they decide that they finally got to include Indigenous people as part of the solution, who are they going to go to? And that's what really concerns me. The failure to think about the long-term importance of capacity building has just been something that has let those communities down. And sorry you asked the question, because I feel really passionately about it, because I've seen it destroyed that way, and I just think it's unforgivable. It's just unforgivable.
Can you take two more questions?
I can take two more questions.
Okay, there are two more questions. There's over here, and then, sorry, there's a man at the back. But you're after him.
Thanks to Raymond and his staff for organising a great session tonight, and thank you, Larissa, for persevering through adversity. I was one of those people in 1967 that supported the changes. I've observed all of the efforts that have taken place over the last 40 years. I guess I have some despair that we still don't seem to be getting anywhere. I do have some concerns that changes to the constitution or other legal mechanisms are going to produce any beneficial results. I'm heartened to hear that Menindee seems to have found a way forward without the input of legislation and governments and lawyers and the like. Just a couple of things on reconciliation. At the Australia Day issues that we had recently, Mr. Paul Coe is quoted as saying, "Either you respect us as a sovereign people or piss off out of our country." Do you think that sort of talk is helpful in?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. Of course, I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's helpful to take those extreme views from the Aboriginal community as being prevalent any more than it is to take the extreme views from the non-Aboriginal community as being reflective of the whole of the country. So I think... Well, no, I didn't, actually. I think you've listened to The Australian and misunderstood what I said. I do think that there is what you're highlighting is the need for us to have longer term conversations that are ongoing and meaningful and don't just happen when there's flashpoints in race relations. If we built our community relationships, say in Redfern, for example, the times in which there's conflict with the police, we wouldn't get anywhere. You have to really invest in much more meaningful, ongoing dialogue that doesn't privilege extreme points of view. But I did just want to pick up on one thing you'd said earlier in what you were saying about the role of the legal system and the constitution. I would stress that I think the best solution to these problems is when you have people from Menindee who are able to do what they do without bureaucrats, without academics, without lawyers. I think when we look at the role that the legal system plays in terms of rights and the role that the constitution plays in terms of a playing field, they're really the last term solutions. They shouldn't be the first port of call. So I do really agree with you that you can be sceptical about the role that they play, because you don't want that to be the way in which we always have a conversation. In a way, it goes back to, you don't want to be the conversation we have about reconciliation shouldn't be about the Hind Marsh Island Bridge case. It's got to be much more meaningful than that. And it is in lots of ways. So let me say something positive about that. When we can talk, I often think when we talk about reconciliation with these, you know, in terms of the enormity of the problems that we overcome, we need to overcome, and the enormity of the challenges around education, health in particular, and literacy is one of the things that are very close to my heart. We do forget that we sometimes in everyday, in our Aboriginal communities, we don't live in a silo. We interact with non-Aboriginal people every day. The best people in our schools are non-Aboriginal people sometimes. The people who've changed our lives when we've seen that there's an opportunity for us beyond what our community knew are often non-Aboriginal people. My mother's not Aboriginal, and I think for me, we can simplify the us and them about this rather than appreciate that for many of us, we're actually parts of families that are already exercising reconciliation and parts of communities that live that every day. So I just do think it's important that we look at the strength of that rather than always come in from the negative and the enormity of the challenge.
Last question.
Thank you. Look, I've tried to read the Australian Constitution and gave up on it because it's mainly about property and electing the type of people that will maintain property rights. Reconciliation for me is kind of undoing the land theft, unstealing the land. So I don't know how you incorporate that in your discussion or debate, because you know it hasn't served any community well, including the Indigenous people most so. But since our Constitution's been alive, there's been booms and busts in property, putting all sorts of people in fear, and we see the problems today globally. Does reconciliation then possibly ought to be we put the value of today's property at, you know, a blanket and a kilo of flour, and therefore end speculation and puts resources into education, Aboriginal education, white education, and then it actually changes the whole relationship between people and land for whites and blacks, and also might even help create another constitution that gets rid of a layer of government, and that layer of government probably be getting rid of the states. Now, that kind of debate for me probably is reconciliation, unstealing the land. But I don't hear much of that.
I think the point you make about from a kind of point of pure reconciliation, how do we go back and undo the impact of colonisation and the dispossession of Aboriginal people is probably a starting point that the people in the community who said to me, what's the point of talking about reconciliation? It's about white people feeling good about themselves. That's kind of the starting point that they would want to have a discussion about. I think it's true to say, and I can talk about constitutional issues all night, but it doesn't resolve the fact that there is a strong feeling within the Aboriginal community that even if you fix the playing field, that you don't actually solve the fundamental. That kind of fixes it for all Australians. That's the foundation document. But it doesn't answer the fact that there's still a question about the legitimacy of that document and the claim in the first place. I think there's a pragmatic thing about how far can you go and undo that. But I think asking the question and having that perspective and trying to think, what would it be like from an Aboriginal perspective to think about that are interesting parts of having a dialogue around reconciliation. Just to finish off with the point about land that you raised, because we haven't talked about that much tonight, and I think it is fundamental. A lot of Aboriginal people want their land back because they feel that they have a relationship to it. They're custodians, and they want to be able to have that custodian relationship, their cultural obligation, responsibility to it met. There is also a view that land is the key to an economic self-sufficiency, the way it's always been. We might have hunted and gathered off it once, but now there are other ways that in which land can become a resource, and that it's part of that ability for communities to be self-sufficient is and to get out of what's often called the welfare mentality, is to have their own land. It's been the great disappointment, I think, for many people about the nature of native title, that it doesn't allow that. It really just allows you to exercise whatever your cultural relationship with the land is. Sometimes people negotiate an outcome beyond that, but native title in its pure form only recognises that attachment to land. But it's important to remember that around the country there are examples of where governments have gone beyond just saying, well, gee, that's a tough break and you might be able to get some native title, and if not, you've got the Indigenous Land Council. And New South Wales is a good example of that. A lot of people don't know that they've had a Land Rights Act there since 1983, so before Mabo. It allows Aboriginal people to claim land that is Crown land that's not used for another essential purpose, so you don't have to show the connection to land that the Yorta Yorta were required to show. You just have to show that the government doesn't need it anymore and you can start to claim it. Under that system, over $2 billion worth of land has been given back to Aboriginal people. Now, that land on the coast is worth a lot more than the land, say, out at Walgett, where my family's from. But the land can be used for anything. So some people have gone into partnerships with National Parks and Wildlife to look after the land. Some have used it for cultural purposes. Others have built houses on it. They don't do that so much now that they're required to lease that land back to the government. But it was used for social housing. It was used for community centres and schools. It was used for a whole range of things. And it's even been used by some communities joint ventures development with developers. Controversial, but it's created resources for the community. With the money that's been generated through that system, the Land Council now has a $30 million education fund for Aboriginal kids going through school. And it's put in $120 million into reserves to fix infrastructure in houses, which the government matched. Now, there was a controversial argument that said that the government's responsible for putting that infrastructure into reserves, but they never had, and they were never going to, until the Land Council said, we'll put in half if you put in the other half, and then they did. So there are examples around the country that you can see, and I think it's interesting that we don't really hear about those successes. They have to kind of be like the women of Menindee under the radar, because we're kind of looking at always at the negative stuff. But I think there are some really good examples of people kind of reclaiming that. And the great thing about the Land Council, the Land Rights Act, that goes to the point you were making, is the preamble to that doesn't talk about native title and connection to land. It says quite fundamentally, and in black and white, this is an act that's about giving land reparation to the dispossessed people of New South Wales. If there's any grey area when the courts are deciding whether to grant land or not, they look at that preamble and go, well, I guess that's pretty clear. We've got to decide the ambiguity by looking at that. And I think it's a really good note to end on, because it shows that you can actually have, this was the Rand government that brought this in, that you can actually have this kind of meaningful, generous, workable structure within the Aboriginal community. And it doesn't mean the sky falls in, and it's really workable. The other thing that I'll just finish on this about that system is it creates 120 local land councils and a state land council, with one in three Aboriginal people in New South Wales are members of their local land councils because they see it as meaningful. Somebody like me is a member. I'm not going to ever get a house or a scholarship. I don't want that from it. I'm just proud to be a member of my local land council because that means something to me. And there are a lot of people who feel that way. And it has created the largest rep body in the country. This federal government never talks to them. It never consults with them. It kind of treats them like they don't exist, which is a lesson in and of itself. But I think it's a really good example of the fact that this was a structure put in by a government, and it's been very workable, and has, you know, the fact that you don't hear about it means that it's probably working really well.
You're going to have to clap again. Not yet. I just want to thank Larissa for a really moving presentation. And I'm not going to say much, but one thing that really struck me when one thinks about the difficulty of this word reconciliation, which is a difficult word just because it can suggest that the Indigenous peoples have done something to the non-Indigenous peoples, such that the non-Indigenous peoples should take up an attitude of being reconciled to the wrong that's being committed to us, which is, of course, a nonsense. But I was struck by how, with what ease you move between one kind of we and another kind of we. You said at one stage, when we draft the Constitution, and then you spoke very movingly, when we, meaning the Indigenous peoples and actually a more local community than that. And I was struck by the fact that you felt no tension in that movement. And that itself is, I think, a wonderful thing. So,